The committee will come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but we are going to begin this morning with a presentation from the University of Minnesota on preparing for aging Minnesota. And today we have with us Terry Brock, the Associate Vice President for the Academic Health Center. And who else do we have here?
I'll do the introductions in just a moment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Terry Bach. I'm Associate Vice President and Chief of Staff for the Academic Health Center, and thank you very much for inviting my colleagues and me to talk about the university's work in preparing for an aging Minnesota. Before we get into the heart of the presentation, just a few words about who we are. The university's Academic Health Center is actually one of the most comprehensive health sciences centers in the country, and it includes all of the health sciences schools of the university, so dentistry and medicine, nursing, pharmacy, public health, and veterinary medicine. We're heavily engaged, obviously, in education, research, and in clinical care. We have 6,200 students, and we train and educate 70% of all of the health care professionals in the state. We conduct over $400 million of health research, principally funded by the National Institutes of Health in a wide variety of areas. And we also see over a million patients in our hospitals and clinics. So that's just a snapshot of who we are. This is a chart I'm sure you have seen before. Minnesota is getting older. In 1950, the number of individuals 18 to 24 equaled the number of people over 65, and that gap has been increasing ever since, particularly since 1985. And that's what we're here to talk about today, the aging of Minnesota's population. I believe you've had a number of presentations by the state demographer, so a number of these statistics are quite familiar. By 2030, Minnesotans over 65 will double. Aging of Minnesota's population will dominate the demographic landscape for the next 25 years as baby boomers like me turned 65. And we will not only age as individuals, but as a society. And this has profound implications for the state, and we're here today to talk about the impact on health. As we know, the demand for health and long-term care and its costs will increase exponentially. Illness and disease increase with age. Chronic conditions such as cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, obesity, arthritis, and pain among the elderly are increasing. 90% of all adults, according to the National Institutes of Health, over 60 have at least one chronic condition, and 25% of all adults have two or more chronic conditions. So the majority of our health care and related economic costs are for the cost of chronic disease and associated risk factors.
Vice President Bach, we have quorum now, so I would like to call the meeting to order, and now you can proceed.
Okay. Thank you. The university plays an essential role in Minnesota's status as one of the healthiest states in the nation, and we will play a critical role in meeting the challenges of a rapidly aging and increasingly diverse population. We do that by educating and training the state's health professional workforce, by discovering new treatments, cures, and ways to promote health, working with you to help shape health policy, developing and piloting new models of care, and providing top-quality health care services to the state. So with me today are four of our leading experts in aging and the care of the elderly. Jim McCullough from the medical school, Shannon Wright from the College of Pharmacy, Joe Gagler from the School of Nursing, and Beth Vernick from the School of Public Health. Also with us is Marilyn Speedy, who is the Dean of the College of Pharmacy. It's hard, and even the hour we have to cover all the things we do here at the university in terms of geriatrics and aging. This is a sample of, and you will be hearing from our best but we're more than willing to come back and to also serve as a resource to this committee as you're dealing with some very important issues facing the state. So I will let each of the presenters introduce themselves as they begin their presentation. So, Jim?
Thank you, Terry. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm very pleased to and honored to be presenting this morning to the House Aging and Long-Term Care Policy Committee. My name is Jim Pakala, and I am a family physician and geriatrician at the University of Minnesota. I am the associate head of the Family Medicine and Community Health Department. In geriatrics, I've done a fair amount of work nationally. I'm a past president and board chair of the American Geriatric Society, which is the leading professional society for geriatric medicine. I'm a co-author of this handbook, which I don't get any royalties for, but a proud co-author of this handbook, Geriatrics at Your Fingertips, which is actually used fairly widely across the country and in other countries as well to guide clinicians in how to take care of older adults. My role this morning is to set the stage a little bit for the rest of the speakers and to provide a little bit of a presentation on some of the needs of taking care of older adults in Minnesota and how we think about those challenges in caring for older adults, particularly those with complex needs. So providing care for older adults is actually a very challenging endeavor. Why? I would submit that there are two types of challenges that make it very particularly difficult. The first is the challenge of complexity, and the second is the challenge of heterogeneity. First, let me talk a little bit about complexity. This is the equation that I teach my medical students and residents and other healthcare professional learners. And the equation is multiple chronic diseases plus problems in other domains equals functional decline. So I'm talking about the older adults who encounter challenges to their health and function as they age, not those who are Olympic athletes at age 90 and get their names read over the Today Show in the morning. So first let me talk about chronic diseases. Chronic diseases are the engine for aging and disability. And I divide chronic diseases into three categories that I think is a useful concept. The first are sensory deficits. Chronic diseases primarily from hearing loss and visual problems from macular degeneration and cataracts and problems like that. There are also chronic physical deficits from chronic diseases such as arthritis, heart failure, which you see on the upper right, causing difficulties with physical functioning. And the last type of chronic disease category is in cognitive deficits, and the landscape in this is dominated by Alzheimer's disease. Here is a picture of two famous people who had to heroically struggle with Alzheimer's disease at the end of their lives. So chronic disease is the engine for declining health, and certainly at the medical school, we very ardently teach our medical students and our residents about how to care for chronic disease. But there's another half of the equation, and that is problems in other domains. What do I mean by this? Well, we have not just our medical well-being, but we have other functional domains in our lives. We have a well-being financially. We have our own families and our own social structures. We have the environments that we live in. And all of these bear an important role in our overall functioning. In older adults, this can pose some particular challenges and lead to problems. So imagine an older woman living in your community, and she is a widow, and she has mild arthritis, osteoporosis, dementia, early stage dementia, and hypertension. That is not an uncommon list of ailments that I would see in my practice. She is afraid to go out in the wintertime because she's worried about slipping on the ice and falling. So what does she do? She stays in her apartment, gets less exercise, and due to the arthritis becomes much more stiff and immobile. She has her daughter who usually takes her to church and some social gatherings and so forth, and so she's had a pretty rich social life, except then the daughter is called away because her husband or child becomes ill for an extended period or something like that, and is no longer then able to take her, and so there's a social challenge. She takes medicines, and she takes medicines for her high blood pressure. So one day, she'll take her medicine for high blood pressure, and due to her mild dementia, she forgets that she's taken her blood pressure pill, so she takes it again. She takes a double dose. So this then bottoms out her blood pressure and makes her lightheaded. The phone rings at home. She's watching TV. She's immobile. She's afraid to get up. And she springs up to get the phone. And what happens? Her blood pressure plummets. She's stiff from the arthritis. She hasn't been able to get out socially. And running into the kitchen to get the phone, she falls because there's a different pile of rug from the phone to the kitchen. She falls and breaks her hip because she has osteoporosis. Okay, so all of those factors, not just her medical condition, has led to a really unfortunate event, which is a hip fracture. We know that in women over 90, half of them with a hip fracture over 90 will be dead in a year. So what the common pathway of this interacting series of chronic diseases and challenges in other domains leads to are what we call geriatric syndromes. And these are conditions that befall older people who have multiple chronic disease and problems in other domains and end up leading to functional decline. And instead of presenting with a flare-up of one disease, they present with a flare-up or with one of these geriatric syndromes, such as a fall, which rarely has one cause. So that is the challenge of complexity. Now, what about heterogeneity? Let's look at a population of older adults, and that's represented by this pie chart. And what we have here are four categories of health and functional ability in the older adult population. And the first category are healthy people. Now, I wouldn't say healthy meaning they're completely free of disease. As Terry just told you, 90% of older adults have at least one chronic condition. I myself have hypertension, so technically I'm chronically ill, but I consider myself healthy. So, in other words, the healthy population are people who are functionally independent. They may have chronic diseases, but those chronic diseases are well controlled and have a minimal impact on their life. But there is a very significant portion of the older adult population in whom the chronic diseases begin to accumulate and progress. And these are people who I put in the chronic illness category. And these are people who see multiple providers. They get bounced in and out of the hospital for flare-ups of different kinds of conditions. They take lots of medication. They spend more of their disposable income on medical care, and more of their time is involved in taking care of their health problems. Eventually, if they continue on this path, they will become frail or what we call multimorbid or complex. And these are people who need help daily from someone else, a family caregiver or someone in a facility in which they happen to live. These are people who have challenges in basic functions of daily living, bathing, dressing, grooming, those sorts of things. And they have multiple chronic conditions and are frail. And then about 2% of the older adult population are within 6 months of dying, and they have some special needs of their own. So what we have here is a very, very heterogeneous segment of the population in terms of health and functional needs, much more heterogeneous than you see in younger adults. Okay, so a population of kids or middle-aged adults, almost all of them would be in that healthy segment. So what we need to be able to do in taking care of a population of older adults is we need to be able to match our care models to the actual needs of older adults. And as they progress around, that was that curved arrow around the pie chart, as they progress around that chart from 12 o'clock all the way around, they need to be transitioned from different care models that best match the needs that they present given their particular makeup. So as patients advance from advanced chronic illness to frail, in other words, from 9 to 12 o'clock on that pie chart that I showed you, those patients are best suited for a geriatrics approach to care. What is geriatrics care? It is a functionally based system of care in which we're really, the end result is that we're looking to make older adults as functionally optimal as possible given the challenges that are presented to them. So we assess when we see a complex older adult not just their medical problems and their chronic illnesses, but also their social functioning, their finances, the environment in which they live. We assess all of those things because we realize that they all have an impact on the outcome. We do that by the use of assessment instruments. We do that by using a team of people. Geriatrics is a team sport, as you're going to find out from my colleagues who will be speaking after me. And care coordination among all of those different providers and experts in those different fields and different domains is critical. And if you don't have that care coordination, then the patient is not going to do well. This is an expensive model of care for a smaller segment of the older adult population. Does it work? Well, I was happy to be part of an effort that was commissioned by the Institute of Medicine in their Retooling for an Aging America report in 2008. And some colleagues of mine and I assembled all of the evidence from randomized control trials and meta-analyses looking at different interventions of geriatric models of care for complex older adults. And we found that there's actually a very, very robust body of evidence that this type of team approach, coordinated care, produces better outcomes for older adults. Less functional decline, more independence, and better health. And that geriatrics model resembles another model of care that is being bandied about with which I'm sure you're all familiar, and that's the patient-centered medical home. And I think of geriatrics as sort of the patient-centered medical home on steroids, because you really have a very, very complex and challenging patient population, but it really is about a coordinated care model with primary care at the center of it. It's a team care model. It's a model in which we're looking at the function of a patient and we're trying to improve their functioning. And it is a model that requires care coordination among team members. So I'm going to stop now, and I'm going to yield the floor to the rest of my colleagues who are team members and will tell you some more about what they're doing over at the Academic Health Center to attack this important problem. Thank you.
Our next presenter is Shannon Wright from the College of Pharmacy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for inviting us here. My name is Shannon Wright. I'm a pharmacist. I'm faculty at the College of Pharmacy. I spend my time teaching pharmacy students, but the bulk of my time is spent caring for elderly patients at Hennepin County Medical Center, where I provide medication management in patients' homes and also for patients in skilled nursing facilities. So I want to spend a few minutes and talk to you about pharmacy's perspective on healthy aging for Minnesotans. So we know that medication-related problems cost the U.S. health system almost $180 billion annually. And what I think is interesting is that we might actually be the adverse medication events from in our elderly might actually be underappreciated. There was a study that came out just a couple weeks ago that looked, it was a retrospective claims database analysis, and looked at the consequences of using common medications like antihistamines and antidepressants and how likely those medications are to cause new cases of dementia. And we found that, the investigators found, that even patients who use these medications for short durations of time and maybe at lower doses are still at risk for developing new cases of dementia. So I think that speaks to the fact that we might not even know or understand the scope of adverse medication events that happen in elderly patients. Here are some senior care pharmacy facts that speak to themselves. But rather than go through these statistics, I want to tell you a patient story of a patient I saw just in January that really is an illustration of these statistics. So as I mentioned, I provide medication management for patients in their homes for Hennepin County Medical Center. Shortly after New Year's Day, I visited a 60-year-old female named Barb. She had just come out of the hospital because she had a COPD exacerbation. While she was in the hospital, her insulin was drastically changed. She was put on a higher dose, and one of her blood pressure medications was changed. And from reviewing the hospital records, we couldn't really understand why her blood pressure medication would have been changed. But she was put on a medication called Norvasc. And one of the common side effects of Norvasc is swelling in your legs. Well, prior to this hospitalization, Barb already had some problems with lower leg swelling. So after she'd gotten home from the hospital and been taking the Norvasc for some time, the swelling in her legs got so much worse that her physician had to put her on a water pill to help with the swelling. So she started taking the water pill, and then that disrupted the amount of potassium that was in her blood. So then she was put on a potassium supplement on top of that. And this just kind of explains a common occurrence in our geriatric patients. Medications can be helpful, but they can also be harmful. We train our pharmacy students that whenever you're caring for an elderly patient has some kind of symptom or problem, as a pharmacist, your job is to look at the medications and investigate whether or not these problems might be related to a medication. And unfortunately, we see that prescribing cascade happens so often where medication side effects are simply treated with another medication. And now you have Barb, a 68-year-old female who's living alone in low-income housing in Minneapolis with swollen legs that are so painful she's not able to get out. She's not able to clean her house. And now she's struggling to find a home health aide who can help her with bathing and just kind of cleaning things around the house. So that really speaks to the pharmacist's role in healthy aging. As a pharmacist, you have a responsibility to review the medications of elderly patients to make sure that medications that they're taking are indicative, are effective, are safe, and convenient to take. And what's particularly important about caring for elderly patients is taking responsibility for all of the medications they're taking, because so many of our elderly patients receive care from more than one prescriber and get medications filled from more than one pharmacy. And a lot of our elderly patients also receive home care services, so they're getting care from public health nurses. So as a pharmacist, it's your responsibility, and we teach our pharmacists to take responsibility for coordinating medication use across the whole healthcare team. So where are we providing this medication management? We have faculty at the University of Minnesota, and we have training sites for our College of Pharmacy students at transitional care units, in community pharmacies, in family medicine clinics, in hospitals, and in patients' homes where I practice. And what's particularly important is taking care of the medication-related needs of elderly patients as they transition through care settings. As I described, Barb was transitioning from hospital to home and back to clinic. And it's during these transitions that patients can be really vulnerable to adverse medication events. Many more of our patients are getting care from skilled nursing facilities. So oftentimes, a classic scenario is a patient has some kind of fall at home, and so they're admitted to the hospital to have some kind of orthosurgery. They're not quite ready to go back home, so they might spend 3 weeks at a skilled nursing facility where they can get rehab, physical therapy, occupational therapy, to be healthy enough to get back to independent living at home. At the University of Minnesota, I worked with a team of researchers, and we developed a care model that we recently tested with Augustana Transitional Care Unit. And unfortunately, transitions of care has been kind of a buzzworthy topic, but skilled nursing facilities have really been left out of transitions of care initiatives. And patients are usually transitional care facilities for about 3 weeks. Medicare requires consultant pharmacists to review the medication charts of patients in transitional care facilities every 28 days. But if the average length of stay is 21 days, a lot of patients are missing out on that pharmacist review of medications. So we wanted to come up with some kind of model that addressed that gap. We developed the model that's displayed here, and it really covers medication management across transitions. So the model involves a pharmacist reconciling and reviewing medications at the point of admission when people are coming to the transitional care unit right after they've discharged from the hospital. That pharmacist reviews medications, works with the patients and their caregivers, and makes sure that any medication changes that have been made are indeed intentional. The pharmacist does the same thing right before the patient leaves the transitional care unit, and at that point coordinates any kind of medication changes or medication-related needs with the patient's community-based healthcare team. So that would be primary care providers and public health nurses. And then, after that patient has been home for about a week or two, the pharmacist either goes out to the patient's home or gives a follow-up phone call to make sure that the patient's doing well with their medications. So we evaluated this model because we thought that by covering the medication management needs of these patients across these transitions, we might be able to reduce the chances of someone going back to the hospital or back to the emergency room after they leave the transitional care unit. And so we did a comparison. So this shows that ED visits and hospitalizations within 30 days of discharging from the transitional care unit were reduced about 10% with our pharmacist integrated model. So that's just one example of some of the initiatives we have going on at the University of Minnesota related to medications in the elderly. But it's not the only thing we're doing. Medication management is especially important for elderly patients in our rural communities because often those patients have less access to their primary care provider due to geography, yet the pharmacist is really accessible. So that pharmacist in our rural communities plays a key role in caring for that patient's serving their medication-related needs, and also coordinating medication use across the healthcare team. Our College of Pharmacy has a lot of different initiatives in place for educating pharmacy students, but what I think is most impressive about our pharmacy curriculum is we started a new curriculum last fall. Prior to the new curriculum, we used to have a standalone geriatrics course where students learned about medication use in elderly. But thinking about how much the geriatric population is increasing and realizing the complexity of medication use in elderly, we decided that instead of having a standalone course, medication use in the geriatric population would be integrated in all of our courses. So for example, when our students are learning about diabetes or hypertension, they're learning about managing these conditions in elderly patients. So our geriatric education is no longer isolated in the siloed course. We also offer a lot of practice opportunities for students on rotations. And here is just a sampling of our geriatric experts of the College of Pharmacy. We have experts who run the spectrum of doing Alzheimer's research and experts who are in boots on the ground caring for geriatric patients and testing models of care. Thank you so much for
Our next presenter is Joe Gegg.
Before we get to that, we have one question from Representative, a couple of questions. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure whether you wanted to take questions now or wait till the end. I mean, fine either way, but my questions were for this presenter, so should
let's,
I just
let's
go ahead?
Let's do them now.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much for your presentation. I'm so interested in this, and a few years ago I had some bills and was working with some people to try to improve prescribing for exactly some of the things you're talking about because of the, you didn't use the term multi-pharmacy, but I think I recall that as being a term for this, you know, where people are taking lots and lots of different medications and they may be interacting in ways that we're not aware that that's what's causing the problems they have. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you is whether you feel that providers, I mean, and I think, let me just say, I think the role of pharmacists in this is absolutely terrific, but are the providers who are doing the prescribing adequately trained in these interactions? And, you know, is there, are they getting objective, continuing information as drugs come out on the market? Because obviously not everybody is going to be prescribing as part of a wonderful system like you're describing. So could you just address that for me?
Ms. Wright?
That's a good question. I think that, as Dr. Pakala alluded to, caring for geriatrics is really complex, and we do need to educate our prescribers in that complexity. I also think another thing that has to happen with the training of prescribers is team-based care and understanding that the care of geriatric patients is really multifaceted. There's prescribing, and there's also thinking about how the clinic-based care plan interacts with the community-based care plan. So if you're prescribing medications, you really have to think about the whole picture. Does the patient have access to medications? Are they going to be able to administer medications? So I think you're right in that there is special training that our prescribers need to get to care for geriatric patients, but it really relates to team-based care.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I can see that. It makes a lot of sense that these things are too complex now to be just handled by one provider. Another question I had to ask, I was just at a meeting with physician assistants, and they are lobbying, one of the bills that they're lobbying, it's not the first time, is to allow them to be paid by Medicaid for managing psychiatric drugs. And one of the things they say is that exactly what you're talking about, somebody comes out of the hospital, they're on some psychiatric drugs, and then they need to have those things, they need a check to see how they're doing and maybe have some adjustment a short time after they come out of the hospital. So I don't want you to comment on the PA's part of it, but I was just wanted to know if in your model and what you're talking about, how do mental health drugs fit in there? Because I know that presents a whole other bunch of complication, and I can only imagine a lot of these drugs are being given also to elderly patients. And is that part of this need to have this? Is that built into what you're telling us?
It's absolutely
That's
built
right.
in. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's absolutely built in. One of the key roles of a pharmacist is to really take responsibility for all of the medications. And so what happens is when patients see providers who are specialists who maybe take care of their psychiatric care or maybe just their anticoagulation medications, you lose out on that perspective of, well, how are the medications interacting with each other? And especially with psychiatric medications, those can have some really bad side effects in elderly patients. So when we're caring for patients who come through the transitional care unit, we're looking at all medications. And I think that's key. When you're reviewing medications in a geriatric patient, you have to look at all of them.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you.
All right, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a general question. My mother was in the hospital a number of years ago in another state, but the deal was she was given conflicting medications, which obviously we eventually found out. But even the way you're talking, the problem is the doctor's already giving the prescription, so you're kind of doing a check after the fact. And in my mother's case, there were some problems that then you had to go back and correct. So is there a better way of before the prescription is even given?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Drug Commission recommends that medications be reviewed at each transition. So what we learned with the model we came up with, because when we first started the model, we were just looking at that transition from leaving the facility and going home, and we realized that a lot of it was really reactive, and you had to always be thinking upstream. And so I think that it's frequent reviews of medications, and especially at each juncture, each transition point, and it's prioritizing problems and also, in your mother's case, anticipating problems.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a general question, and that has to do with when a person is prescribed a new medicine by his doctor, is that somehow reviewed by the pharmacist? And one of the reasons I ask is say a person's on three medications and they get a prescription to go to the pharmacist for a new medication. Does that pharmacist ask what other medication are you getting? Because I don't know if that's generally done.
That's right.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. So it best practice it would be done. And typically, our pharmacists and community pharmacies are relying on the medication list that they have access to in their dispensing record. And what can be complicated is if patients are using more than one dispensing pharmacy or they're using mail order pharmacies, because community pharmacists just won't have access to a comprehensive medication list.
Thank you. Representative, okay. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wright, in your example, you said that Barb went into the hospital and for some unknown reason both her insulin and her blood pressure medication were raised. Was there ever any investigation as to why that happened? Again, speaking personally, I've gone in with my mother's in an institution now, and when I've asked about certain medications, nobody can even tell me why she's on them. So, you know, unless I've asked, and then they got discontinued, but there was no rationale. Nobody knew why she was still taking them. So in your example, did anybody go back and say, why did you increase the insulin and the blood pressure medication given these side effects and things?
That's right.
So in Barb's case, we went back and reviewed her hospital records to see, and her primary care physician did try and follow up with the team that was caring for her in the hospital. But you really raise a good point in that a lot of health systems struggle to provide clear, concise documentation that explains why medication changes are made during hospitalizations. And that documentation doesn't always exist, and if it does exist, it doesn't always get to all of a patient's providers in the community.
Representative Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the answer is no, there really wasn't any kind of rationale for why it was bumped up or any clear-cut reason for it.
No, not that we found.
Thank you.
Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we making any progress in the area of medical records to keep all of the physicians that are seeing someone up to date? And my question is really based on my mother's experience. I used to be the one who took her to appointments. And we would go from specialist to specialist, and every single time I would update the medications list, and I would come back, go to the next one, and it was, you know, and come back, and it would never be right. It was, and, you know, the same office that I had already told that same updated list would still not have it right. So are we getting toward a unified medical information system at all, or is that somewhere in the future?
Ms. Wright.
Well, I can, Mr. Chairman, I can speak to the medication list issue. The problem with medication lists is that they're so dynamic, and they're affected by prescribers. They're also affected by patients' habits, whether or not they're taking medications.
Representative Yaruso?
Yeah, but I'm talking about the computerized central information systems that, and in some cases this was within the same system because she was a health partner's patient. Not all of her providers were within their system. So we're not talking about an issue of what they were taking on their own or not taking on their own. This is, I was giving them her actual list of prescribed medications each time and updating them on the changes, and that information was neither shared nor properly updated. So that's what I'm focusing on. Are we ever going to have a system where all the doctors with a patient will know what has been prescribed for them that they're taking, and that it'll actually get updated so that everybody has the correct information? And I keep hearing rumor. I'm no longer, you know, I'm not old enough myself, and my parents are gone, so I'm not dealing with Medicare at all personally. But I hear from people that they're supposed to be trying to work toward, you know, having a better information system. Are we getting there? Are we ever going to get there is the question.
Ms. Wright.
Hello. I am Beth Vernig, and I'm professor and associate dean in the School of Public Health. And unfortunately, I actually think I can help answer your question. And it may sound a little cynical, but I think we're making progress, but we've got a really long way to go. And the challenges are a few. And part of the challenge, I think, is, personally, I think is almost conceptual, in that we took these paper charts. Remember the old days of paper charts? And some, you could tell if you were get a thick chart or a thin chart, right? And we put them all on a computer. So now people have a thick file or a thin file, but we haven't really changed what we used to have in paper. So you remember you used to go and you'd sit and your doctor would like page and page and find something and you'd say, no, it's there, and they'd look some more. Well, we're still doing that. And I think the problem is that somebody said one time that medical records are like a scrapbook. People put things in them for various reasons. They're important to them at the time. So if you think about going through old scrapbooks, or I've got my kids, I'm not organized enough to have scrapbooks. They just have a box, and stuff gets put in there. And sometimes you go back through and go, oh, that was really good. I'm glad I saved it. And sometimes you wonder what you were thinking. And there's stuff you wish you would have saved. Well, I think medical records are a lot like that. And so I think it's going to take us a while to change how we think about medical records. And I think when that happens, then what you're asking for is actually all going to happen. But it's going to require us to really rethink what we're doing and how to make it work. And that's just going to take some time. I think people are moving in that direction. So it's part technology and it's part personality. But I agree with you completely. It's exactly where we need to go, and we're moving there.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final thought. Medications would be a good place to start, because it's the one of the things in the record that you have a concrete prescription for a specific drug at a specific dose with a specific timing done on a specific date, and so it's less fuzzy than some of the rest of the data. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Vernick, anything to that?
No, thank you.
Okay, next we have Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to add to this latest conversation. I had another question, but I've had cause to be at clinics quite a bit lately in hospitals. My husband tore his rotator cuff. All the meds were updated every time we went someplace. There were changes made every time, and it was very clear. And I've had the system that the clinic/hospital has now dealt with is excellent. If he calls a doctor, or I happen to ask questions about it, it's once in a while we have to change something when you're going through the list, but it might be a dosage that you've adjusted, but it has been very clear. And to that conversation, also in the last 2 years, I've spent quite a bit of time with my dad, and he's gone to Abbott, Grand Forks, All True, Crookston Hospital, so it's three different systems, and we've had really good success, even though it's been time differentiation of different issues. But I've had real success with them knowing the records. There are some times that you have to say, no, that MRI was taken, or there's a more recent test taken, and they'll look, and, oh, yep, here it is. But it's all been on computer and very, very succinct. So I'm really happy to see. Now, nursing homes, I don't know, are as updated. That's probably a little more challenging for them. But anyway. So much for that. My question for you is, when we're talking about integration of pharmacies or pharmacists in maybe more of a long-term care conversation as people move, transition, how does that work in the rural areas? I'm just thinking my pharmacists are pretty taxed. So I'm kind of like, how would you do that? I realize that I'm the kind of person who calls, and they're like, oh, you're calling about, okay, because I have a couple family members I take care of. Anyway, so that's my question.
That's right.
Sherman. Well, I think it happened. I think one of the things that the pharmacy profession is looking at is making sure that each member of the pharmacy team is working to the top of their license. So I think that pharmacists can use pharmacy technicians a little bit differently, so that a pharmacist is not doing things that a technician could do. And that frees up a pharmacist's time to do things like take responsibility for medication management across transitions of care and in nursing homes.
Representative Keel. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back, and it's really more of a statement to punctuate what Representative Yarusso said. I believe this needs to be a top priority in the medical world. I'm going to get some sort of unified comprehensive system that makes sense for everyone. You get a little bit emotional because we're all talking about our parents and stuff like that, and I just don't think there's an excuse in the medical profession. My mom used to have hallucinations because she'd be over-medicated. My dad showed signs of dementia because of over-medication. And these are two people who are very smart, very professional people. This is not people like, oh, they're just confused people that are little old people getting ready to die sort of thing. These are people that were still very much trying. And when their medications were adjusted, they'd go back to being themselves within weeks sometimes. And my mom was sort of, for unique circumstances, was very computer literate. She used to carry around a CD of all of their medical stuff to every single doctor they went, and we had the same problem. The information was always wrong. So I would encourage, because you're with the University of Minnesota, and we are hailed as one of the great medical institutions in the nation, I would encourage you to make this a priority. Come up with a system that can be used nationwide. Be the leader in this, because when it comes to geriatric care of the aging population, this is a big problem. And I'd like to see it fixed.
Anything to that? Ms. Ryder, Vice President Buck?
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is a priority of ours to be working on how with providers and developing new models of care. And so that's a key research interest of ours.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative
just
Miller?
One more small follow-up. In the computer age, I just, and again, I'm not barking at you. It's because you are here in front of us. But I don't accept scrapbook. We're in the computer age. We are in the Internet age to where there are industries that are doing phenomenal things with computers. And I understand if there are some legal issues, some legal hurdles as to privacy information and things like that. I understand that. But I think we can get that figured out because I'm pretty sure that all of our elderly would be more than happy to work together towards getting their medical records straightened out. So I think this need, I appreciate it that you say you're working on it. Just please work on it real soon. Thank you.
All right, anything on that? Okay, before we get to Representative Tice's question, we will, after this question, let you finish their presentation and take questions at the end for that and then go into House File 316. After that. So, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, everybody's talking about their mom and dads, and my mom and dad pretty much take care of themselves. My dad is dangerous enough in that he was an EMT most of the time to know what he's doing, so I don't worry so much about their prescriptions. As I'm thinking about myself, as we're talking about, you know, instances where you might end up in the hospital and your prescriptions get changed, I am a reluctant prescription taker. I am fighting it every step of the way. And when I turned 50, my family history smacked me upside the head. And so I'm thinking now, if I'm working with a person and I'm going to a pharmacist, I'm not seeing multiple folks, and I can go to the hospital and my dosages get changed, do I have a say in that? And my second question is, does the pharmacist at the hospital get to see what else I'm taking, or does he see anything when that dosage is administered?
Right.
That's a great question. So most of the health systems in Minnesota, nationally speaking, we're ahead of the game in transitions of care models. And so most of the health systems in Minnesota have policies in place where a medication history is taken upon admission. And that medication history is usually verified with your community pharmacy, with public health nurses, et cetera. So coming into your hospitalization, the health systems are doing their best, their due diligence, to get a complete medication list. Any medication order that's made during your hospitalization is reviewed by a pharmacist, and most of our health systems have initiatives in place at the point of hospital discharge where the healthcare team, oftentimes it's the pharmacist, is comparing the medications that you're going to be going home on and comparing those to the medications you came in on. So at that point, we should be able to catch discrepancies, to reconcile changes that were not intentional.
All right, back to your presentation.
Our next presenter is Joe Gagler from the School of Nursing.
Okay. Chair Schulmacher and members, my name is Joe Gogler. I am an associate professor in the School of Nursing, and I hold a dual appointment in the Center on Aging at the University of Minnesota. My research interests focus primarily on Alzheimer's disease and long-term care, in particular trying to support families who are caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's disease or related dementia. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm so pleased that this committee was created this year to focus on the important health issues facing the aging population of Minnesota. The School of Nursing is addressing the health care needs of aging Minnesotans in two distinct ways. First, it's through our continuous development of a highly educated nursing workforce. And then secondly, through research discoveries that lead to improved prevention and care for older adults with chronic conditions. And I wanted to start by talking a little bit about some of our academic programs. School of Nursing produces a total of about 310 graduates each year. Two-thirds of those graduates sit for the Registered Nurse Licensing Exam, otherwise known as NCLEX. These are well-rounded individuals with four-year degrees who participate in courses and clinical experiences focused on the health of adults and seniors. About 100 of our graduates are from our doctoral programs, which I'll describe in the next slide. So we offer four programs in total. The first two, the BSN and the Master of Nursing, prepare students to become registered nurses. In the BSN program, around a third of our undergraduate students are from outside the 11-county metro area. 49% are from the metro area, and 19% are from outside Minnesota. We also offer two doctoral programs. Our DNP, or Doctorate of Nursing Practice program, is one of the three largest in the country and prepares a range of specialists, including those in adult and gerontological health. Finally, the PhD program is for those who wish to teach at a university and or conduct research. There's really a dire shortage of nursing faculty nationally, and the PhD program is really designed to help prepare individuals to fill those gaps, both in Minnesota as well as outside of it. The School of Nursing's combined enrollment has increased by 20% over the last 9 years. We know and we really believe nurses are uniquely positioned to coordinate the care for an aging population experiencing multiple chronic conditions. This growth has been exciting for us, but also has been intentional as well as hard-fought. Our courses really aren't typical large lecture-based undergraduate courses. Instead, these are really high-touch courses and programs that involve giving every student simulation experiences, lab experiences, and clinical placements in a range of settings throughout the state. Many of these courses focus on the care of older adults in communities and in long-term care facilities, as well as how to best support their caregiving families. We believe there's a lot more growth potential in our programs, given, number one, the continued changing in the aging population here in Minnesota, and then secondly, and perhaps more critically, due to the geriatric care workforce shortage, both in Minnesota and, again, nationwide. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the research that we believe is helping to improve the health and care of Minnesota's older adults. The School of Nursing is heavily involved in clinical research. As of 2014, we were ranked 15th in research funding from the National Institutes of Health among schools of nursing nationally. The School of Nursing also houses one of nine centers of excellence, the Hartford Center for Gerontological Nursing Research. And since 2008, the Hartford Center has delivered seminars to 200 nursing faculty in greater Minnesota nationwide. Why this is so exciting to me, anyway, is that many of these faculty who participated in seminars are from colleges and universities located either in outstate Minnesota or beyond. And what they've been able to do is take back the knowledge they learn in these seminars to really refine and enhance the geriatric coursework at their particular institutions. And we believe in that regard we've been able to at least partially or indirectly address this whole problem of trying to train more people to become geriatric care professionals. The School of Nursing has been successful in gaining support for our work. We have $3.2 million in outside funding for aging-related research last year. Much of this comes from federal grants from institutions like the National Institute of Health or Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, but there's also a combination of state support as well as private and foundation support for our research as well. Our varied research programs develop and test interventions that reduce the progression of chronic conditions, help patients manage symptoms, and improve quality of life. Our programs are identifying new ways to reduce admissions to long-term care facilities, increase independence, and not just live longer, but live with a greater quality of life and autonomy as well. What I think is most important when I talk to people about research that's being done in nursing is it's not research that takes place in a vacuum. It's not purely theoretical. It's not even purely clinical. It's also focused on what we like to call translation, where it's actually trying to identify how can the research that we do be effectively implemented into routine clinical care to help benefit as many Minnesotans as possible. Really believe if that final step isn't achieved in the research process, then the research itself, in at least in some manner, hasn't really worked the way it's supposed to. Wanted to highlight three specific research examples from the School of Nursing, and since I was tasked to present, I'm going to talk about mine first. And so I'm going to share with the committee some of my own work on Alzheimer's disease and long-term care, and more specifically how I've tried to align it with the land-grant mission of the University of Minnesota. So again, these research discoveries can benefit families and care professionals throughout the state. So we know there's around 88,000 people or so who have Alzheimer's disease in Minnesota, and even more importantly, around those people rely on 245,000 family members to receive the care they need. If you actually value that care, it comes to $3.5 billion as of 2013. And to put that into context, the 500th company in the Fortune 500 list in 2013 basically had annual revenue of $4.8 billion, I think. So caregiving in itself, if you value it, it's essentially almost a Fortune 500 industry in and of itself. So this is a very valuable endeavor from at least conservatively an economic standpoint, and that's not even trying to value how much personal meaning it has for those families and the people who receive that care. So my work tries to find ways to support these families and their relatives with memory loss. So if you look at the research circle, I kind of highlighted two specific projects. One was a recently completed five-year project that was funded from the National Institute on Aging that was basically designed to provide a comprehensive psychosocial support program for adult children who cared for parents with Alzheimer's disease. And we found, and we're starting to publish results off of the study, that adult child caregivers, families who received this counseling and support, were more likely to delay admitting their loved ones with memory loss for, on average, 231 more days in, like, say, an assisted living or nursing home compared to those who didn't receive the program. So that was one example of what we believe is research that really helps support families in Minnesota. The second is kind of taking that idea one step further. This is a new five-year project that we're doing from the Agency of Health and Research and Quality, where we're actually going to evaluate the effectiveness of remote health monitoring technology for families who live in the community and are caring for a loved one with memory loss. The technology is really cool. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. It's actually a set of sensors that detect activity and motion activity, and they communicate with each other to determine activity patterns. And if someone kind of acts outside of a given threshold, that system can issue an alert to a family member, care provider, anybody else. And what we're interested in looking and seeing is, number one, does this technology actually keep somebody at home longer? But then number two, does it also increase the sense of security, sense of relief on the part of family members as well? So we're excited about that particular project too. But the reason why I presented this slide to you as well is I wanted to emphasize how this research doesn't operate in a vacuum. It also influences a number of educational initiatives we're doing too. A lot of the work that I do in Alzheimer's disease finds its way into the courses I teach. For example, I teach a first-year seminar on chronic illness in the U.S., which has been a lot of fun. Many pre-med and pre-nursing students take that particular class, but also community outreach initiatives as well. Done a lot of community education seminars really throughout the state on memory loss and caregiving. I noticed, I think, at least one of the representatives from Crookston, I've actually been there and gave a presentation all through the northern parts of the state. This was a few years ago, which was fun. And what we'd like to do is to actually expand that community education engagement, make it a more routine, regular part of what we're doing with our Alzheimer's research program, to kind of get that education out throughout the state. And really our primary community education activity that we do in my research group is what's called the Caring for a Person with Memory Loss Conference, which we've held annually each year since 2008. It's a free conference that anybody can attend, families and care professionals. We usually get around 200 to 300 attendees there each year, which kind of speaks to the need for this kind of education for families. And much of the work we do influences the type of information we try to provide at this conference. It's also live streamed and recorded, so anybody, for example, people who don't live in the metro area who have a hard time traveling to the U can watch it or view the recordings at any time. And again, in collaboration with Dr. Spicala, who you just heard from, Dr. Gene Wyman from the School of Nursing, and Dr. Bob Kane from the School of Public Health, we really want to take this on the road. go and present it physically beyond Minnesota to other regions throughout the state of Minnesota. And those three individuals will be leading a federal grant application to hopefully allow us to do so. And then the third circle there, I won't belabor this much, but what we're trying to do is kind of merge our education and research interests in Alzheimer's disease with a strong clinical component. And in this case, we envision an interprofessional memory care management clinic. And again, Dr. Spicala has been very helpful in providing his advice on that, as well as others. And we're close to hopefully getting that off the ground. So I present this to you here because I think in combination, research alone, education alone, clinical service alone doesn't necessarily meet the needs of Minnesotans. It certainly doesn't align itself with the land-grant mission. And this small component of research in Alzheimer's disease and long-term care, we tried to do that. The second example, a very interesting example, is on incontinence. This certainly is not a difficult topic to talk about, either within families or professionally. Incontinence is known as a lack of bladder control, bowel control, or not being able to get to the toilet in time, but it's really a major issue for an aging population. It's an understudied disability. It often prompts increasing and more costly levels of care for those who suffer from it. It's often a primary consideration for family members when making decisions about moving a loved one to a long-term care facility. And it affects 45% of frail older adults living at home and then 60% living in a nursing home. Consider just the financial implications. We could find a simple non-invasive intervention to kind of manage, if not prevent, incontinence. And that's exactly what three of my colleagues are doing at the School of Nursing through targeted exercise, fiber supplements, and other means. And two are actually recognized national leaders on this topic, Drs. Gene Wyman and Donna Bliss. And finally, I wanted to wrap up with talking about some of the current research going on peripheral artery disease, or PAD. This causes blockages in the arteries that feed the legs. This also limits blood flow to the legs and deprives the leg muscles of the oxygen and nutrients needed to perform normal activities of daily life. Not many people talk about PAD, but it affects around 8 million people in the United States and really can cause debilitating leg pain when even walking short distances. In its most extreme form, it actually can cause amputations or gangrene. So what two of my colleagues are doing, and they've been working on this for the last 10 years, it's Dr. Diane Treat Jacobson and Dr. Ulf Baronis. They've actually found a really interesting regimen of exercises that can reduce the painful symptoms of PAD in most patients. And what's so interesting about it is it's an exercise protocol, but not what you really expect. It's actually a wheel that you just use your arms with. And so what they did is they compared those who actually use the wheel exercise with those who do more routine exercise and those that get no exercise. And what they found was that the arm exercise was just as efficacious as using routine exercise. But what's even better than that is if you're talking about somebody with PAD, having them do a full exercise routine probably isn't the best idea because of the likely complications that can arise in one's lower body. So that's another example of some of the exciting translatable research that's going on at the School of Nursing. So really to conclude, you know, in collaboration with colleagues throughout the University of Minnesota, but even more importantly with community partners throughout the state of Minnesota, the School of Nursing is making important breakthroughs that are improving the quality of life, reducing health care costs, and improving outcomes for older adults. These discoveries, coupled with these comprehensive academic programs I described earlier, are helping Minnesota to fill the gap in the geriatric care workforce shortage.
Thanks, Joe. And our final presenter is Beth Burnett from the School of Public Health.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to have a chance to talk about the work we're doing in the School of Public Health. You will notice a difference between the School of Public Health and everybody else. We are not clinically focused. We focus particularly on research, policy development, and education. But it's very collaborative, and you will see some of the same themes that my colleagues have mentioned picked up in my talk. I want to first point talk about aging as a key focus in our school. We are in the middle of a strategic planning process right now where we're looking at public health 2030. So we're asking ourselves the question of where do we need to be in 2030 and what are we going to do to make sure we are there now? So rather than saying, oh my gosh, we didn't expect this, we are saying we're going to be purposeful in how we are moving. And aging is one of, in fact, was actually the number one issue identified by our faculty. We recognize aging directly, but also that it intersects with other key areas of School of Public Health focus. mental health, neurology, and cognition, chronic disease, infectious disease, injury, economics and management, and equity, among others. So again, we see aging as a very multidisciplinary and complex, but also incredibly important issue for our school and for the state of Minnesota. Over 20% of the faculty in our school are engaged in aging or long-term care research in one way or another. We have three centers that have a direct focus on aging research. We've got our Center on Aging. We've got the Minnesota Area Geriatric Education, or MAGEC, which we have had. It's a federally funded program since 1988. Dr. Pakala is a key member of that as well. And we have the Long-Term Care Resource Center. We also have two centers that are key to our school, which focus on aging more indirectly. It's not the sole mission, but it's a key part of it. And part of it is the Research Data Assistance Center, or RESDAC, which is about a $3 million per year grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. That is the agency that runs the Medicare program. And that the RESDAC facilitates the use of data from the Medicare program for understanding policy, health, and health care for elderly. And that is, we are very proud of it. We are nationally recognized as experts in using information from CMS. And we also advise CMS on policy and on decisions and help them and make guidelines. So it ends up being a great benefit for our state because we are some of the people who can influence policy. We also have the Rural Health Research Center, which focuses on the unique needs of rural populations, which often include things with rural focus. Years ago, I did a study on access to home health care. So in very rural areas, can you, in fact, get home health care reliably to everybody in rural areas? I did a parallel study on rural hospice and found that, in fact, because hospice is largely, or at least originally was conceived as largely home-based, and found there are some counties in the state that do not have home-based hospice. It's simply too far for the hospice workers to travel. We need to think of innovative models of providing palliative care in communities in these areas where the traditional hospice rules just do not work. Public health approach is, first of all, is very prevention focused. We talk about what we would call modifiable risk factors, which is we like to look at things we can change versus things we can't change. So we're constantly trying to focus on where can we intervene, where can we find strategies that will actually make a difference. We're also heavily population-based, so we focus on policy and system changes rather than on individual cases. The individual cases are incredibly important to us because they give us ideas. We hear things, but we come from a perspective that says rarely is there one person with a problem, and where we hear one story, there's probably a whole group of people with the exact same experience, and how can we understand that, and how can we work to improve the health of the entire population? We rely very, very heavily on collaborations. As you have heard today within the university, we work closely with the medical school, the nursing school, the pharmacy school, the dental school, and interestingly, veterinary medicine. We also have incredibly close and important collaborations with the Minnesota Department of Human Services as well as the Minnesota Department of Health. We work with the Veterans Administration Medical Center. We work with local healthcare providers, Allina, Fairview, Mayo Clinic. We work with Medica and United Health as funders and providers. And we also, as I said earlier, advise federal agencies such as CMS on policies and in a collaborative way. So we've got this broad network of inputs and agencies and people we work with. When we think of our research, one big body of research that I think is particularly exciting and important is predictors of healthy aging. And what we've done here is we've actually taken some of our long-standing studies and repurposed them a bit. So these were studies that were begun in the 70s and 80s, a lot of them, that were looking at what predicts who gets some disease, what predicts who gets heart disease, what predicts who gets breast cancer, what predicts who gets osteoporosis, and started to ask this question of what predicts who ages in a way that is healthy and functionally productive. So not just counting diseases, as Dr. Pakala said, a lot of people have a diagnosis, but what is it that differentiates somebody who gets a diagnosis and stays functional with somebody who gets a diagnosis and ends up having functional decline as a result? And how can we understand that, and then how can we help create programs and interventions and policies that will promote the functional progress with in the presence of a diagnosis? And one example is the Iowa Women's Health Study, which, although it is set in Iowa, is actually located and run out of the University of Minnesota. And in that study, we are looking at questions of cancer survivorship. How come some people will get a cancer diagnosis and will bounce back, and other people will get a cancer diagnosis and will struggle returning to functional status? And what can we do to try to promote that, particularly given how common cancer is? The study of osteoporotic fractures, or the SOFT study and the Mr. Oz studies, is explicitly looking at studies of healthy aging. These are both studies that began in the 80s and now have a large number of people who are in their late 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And some of these women, and some of these people are very spry and healthy, and others are struggling and trying to understand predictors and interventions. We spend a lot of work looking at innovative models of care delivery, and you've heard some of these from my colleagues as well. And oftentimes it's really about, our question is, can we link payment models to what we believe is optimal care? So showing that a care model is optimal is one step. The question is then, how can we create a payment model that will incent people to use that model? And those are those are really important studies, because we really do believe that by creating the right incentives, everything will follow. So we ask questions like, what are the health impacts of continuity of care? That may sound obvious to all of us, but in fact, creating the research base is important. Can we show that continuity of care, that seeing one or two physicians, in fact, leads to fewer hospitalizations, less ER use, more compliance with care guidelines, more preventive care? We've talked about the healthcare home. We recently completed a study with the Minnesota Department of Health that looked at healthcare homes with complex chronic diseases. This is the same model that we've been talking about in the context of pharmacy, nursing, and medicine. It's very collaborative. And so what we do is we come in and say, can we create the research base to show that what we all sense can in fact be quantified, and can we help figure out a payment mechanism that will incent people to do it? One of my colleagues related to Alzheimer's is doing a project, she calls it a biography project, and she's looking at long-term care institutions and is working on this idea that if an attempt is made to understand the patients, particularly those with memory loss, to understand their biography, to understand their favorite songs from when they were in their 20s, and work with the staff to understand, to see these long-term care patients, residents, as full people, it will help manage some of the challenges that come with having an older person with memory loss. Knowing that somebody grew up speaking German until they were 20, well, maybe in times of stress we need to make sure there are German-speaking staff around who can interact with her in her first language in times of stress, where maybe, it's as crazy as it sounds, for somebody who's been in the U.S. for 50 years, in times of stress, this person will revert back to German. So working on that and creating the research base to say this isn't just something that we think, it is something we know. We have studies of why can some people take a hit. They get a fracture, they get a diagnosis, they get a new medication, and they seem to roll with it, and others not. It's, again, the complexity that Dr. Pikala talked about, and understanding that and anticipating it, so rather than being reactive, we can be proactive. CMS, that runs the Medicare program, is constantly experimenting with changing payment rates and incentives. Their goals are noble, restricting overuse of care, incenting certain treatment patterns, preventive services, screening, and so on, and saving money. Our question is, do these work to promote health? And do these do what we want them to do? And how can we identify when they work and when they actually don't, so that we can be more purposeful in how we change the Medicare program? We've talked about the long-term care, and I'm not going to do this because I do know we are over time. We also look at organizational management. What are innovative models? What are the structures and resources? And how can we work with organizations to help the organizations be more nimble? How can we make the case for certain models, whether it's information sharing or information management? We developed the nursing home compare system, which is now national. So in summary, we are committed to promoting aging research, teaching, and service. Our portfolio is broad and is funded by state and federal sources, is diverse, prevention-focused, and highly collaborative. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I want to just close with underscoring our commitment to the state's health and to working with you and with others to be able to address the very critical challenges we have with an aging and increasingly diverse population. Obviously, we are doing that in our education and training programs, as well as the research we do and how we're trying to translate that into new models of care and new tools that can be used for the care and the health promotion of the state's population, and in translating that into the actual healthcare services we provide. We are available to this committee as a resource, as a route to you, in to share our expertise, to be able to sit down with you to talk about policy issues. And we are, as the university has, as part of its biennial budget request, put together a proposal called the Healthy Minnesota Initiative, which is focused on what is the university's role in being able to deal with the changing healthcare needs of the state, and particularly the aging population, as well as an increasingly diverse population. There's a workforce component to it, as well as a focus on chronic disease research and new models of care. The items here that I'm highlighting is that we are asking, in fact, for funding to greatly strengthen our education and training programs and research programs in geriatrics and the care of the elderly, as well as programs in mental health, which we all know is a very serious shortage in this state, as well as expanding our dentistry training programs, actually focused on rural communities where there is a huge shortage of dentists. And we are interested in developing a statewide network of primary care teaching clinics across the state, where students across all of our schools and residents across all of our schools can actually learn together in a setting that models the kind of care we want to provide, and that provides care to underserved communities, both in urban Minnesota, but particularly focused on rural Minnesota, where the healthcare shortage needs are the greatest that we need to be dealing with. So you'll be hearing more about that in future meetings, but the sort of highlight of what we're looking for in terms of additional funding for the university.
All right. Thank you, Vice President Bach, and to the panel for your presentation today and all that you're doing to take care of this necessary need that we have in the state. And we look forward to hearing from you in the future and continue to work and do what we can to be a resource for you as you continue on in this work. So thank you very much. In other business, Representative Keel would like to move the approval of the minutes from January 28th, 2015. Is there any discussion on Representative Keel's motion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes from January 28th, 2015, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Now we'll be going into House File 16 to 316 to finish that up. Thank you.
Representative Schumacher, would you like to take up your bill, House File 316, off the table?
Yes, I'd move that we take House File 316 off the table.
Representative Schumacher moves to take House File 316 as amended off the table. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Schumacher, would you like to move your bill, House File 316, as amended?
Yes.
We have the bill before us. Ms. Pinelli, would you please go over the amendments that have already been adopted?
Madam Chair and members, the A1-1 amendment was adopted by the committee last week with an oral amendment that was adopted, and that oral amendment was on the A1-1 amendment on lines 1.6 and 1.7. It removed the language that says employer shared responsibility payments under the Federal Affordable Care Act, public law 111-148, comma. The committee also adopted the A2 amendment and incorporated a change to that amendment on line 1.9. That line now should read, of subdivisions 50 and 51, period. And then there was another oral amendment to the bill, House File 316, on page 4, line 16. Assessments on employers under the Affordable Care Act, semicolon, was removed from the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Pinelli. Representative Schumacher, would you like to make any comments?
Well, we had an hour and 45 minutes worth of discussion on this bill last week, and so I think everyone has a pretty good idea, but this is the nursing home rate reform bill that takes the current fee-for-service model that was started in the early 1990s and reforms it so that we're looking at more of a cost-based program in the state and trying to address things at the cost level and referring to that. So that's all I really have for introductions, and we can get on to the rest of the business.
I have an amendment labeled A3. Representative Lilly, do you want to move Amendment A3?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Before we get to that, I have a quick question. At the end of the last hearing, I requested to get some runs. Were those? I didn't see those in my packet or anything. Were those provided? Because I think it's really pertinent to this entire discussion before we get to my amendment, but really for this bill as we go forward, because I think we have no idea what the impact is or what we're really fully doing. You know, I look around the table and all of our districts are different, but just what do we have any of that? I understand that some of the nursing homes around the state actually have it in their possession, so this information must exist. I just don't know why we don't have it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lilly. It's my understanding that all the facilities have gotten an estimate of what they might expect to see out of this bill, but because the runs should be coming from the department and not from the industry, since the department doesn't have those runs yet, because we haven't gotten the bill in an order that's ready for them, that's the best approach, is to get the runs from the department, because that's going to be the interpretation that's going to actually be put into law instead of just estimates from the industry. And so there aren't runs for this week because we're waiting for the department to have those ready for us.
Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. it just seems, I just kind of continue with my same thought. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I don't know if Representative Russo had a question or ready to move on. Is there, just to kind of continue, would it be possible to get these estimates? I mean, so that we could actually see. I mean, if they do exist, indeed. It was, and I'm a co-author, it would be nice to, I intend to vote for the bill. I mean, but you know, hopefully it comes together and passes, because I think it's, you know, clearly needed. But I just, is there a way that we could get those, you think? Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
For today, the estimates, again, are just industry estimates that the facilities have gotten with that, and I don't think that's the wisest route to go when we're looking at that, just because their interpretation of what this bill does and the department's interpretation can be completely different, and passing out bad information is worse, in my opinion, than having or passing showing one interpretation of one when it's not going to be reflective of what the law will be exactly, then I don't think that's the best route to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think this bill has got a ways to go.
Yes, sir.
And I know it's going to go to Health and Human Services Committee, and it will be fully vetted there. I think the department will have, by that time, runs that will be accepted by all. And I think because of that, we can continue to go and address this bill at this committee at this time without runs, because they will be here before the bill does pass.
Representative Lely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just along the same lines, I mean, I think, I think probably every member voting for this bill will probably be doing it sort of provisionally, because we don't know how it's going to impact our districts, and that can be, as more experienced members know, that can be the rub in all of this, right? But one along that line, too, on page 3 of the bill, Representative Schumacher, there's this part about part of this is going to be the property rate system. It's going to be based on a new property rate system to be developed by the commissioner in consultation with facility providers and other stakeholders, etc. So there's a chunk of this bill that's kind of left for the future to be, it's sort of TBD, to be decided, and I wonder how that's going to figure into the runs that we do see, because part of this is kind of still hanging out there to be decided. Am I interpreting that correctly, Representative Schumacher?
Representative Schumacher or Ms. Thurlow, could you please tell us who you are and who you represent, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Leading Age Minnesota, but here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Representative Liebling, to your question, you're right that there is additional work being done on the property side, which is the other side of nursing facility rates. That provision will not take effect, as you can see in the bill, will not take effect until 2016. So there is another year there. But our anticipation is that as this moves through the process, as we work with the department, we hope to have additional details in additional committees to further provide additional details on that.
So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to sort of finish the thought here, so before members are going to be asked to vote on this with any money attached, we're going to have that fleshed out somewhat, because even though it doesn't take effect until October 1st, 2016, that's within our biennium. So it's going to impact this next budget, presumably. And so I don't know how we can really move the bill through without knowing what that's going to look like.
Madam
Ms. Thurlow.
And Representative Liebling, our hope is that we will have, yes, in the policy committees, that we will have that information to have fleshed out. It certainly will influence the fiscal note, and we're well aware of that. We continue to work with the department with getting technical assistance to make sure that that's a workable system as well.
Representative Liebling?
Yeah, and Madam Chair, and just since, Ms. Thurlow, since we have you at the table, this issue about getting the runs, I mean, I get what the chair is saying. However, this bill kind of is an industry bill, at least initiated that way. And so he indicated that there may be some differences between what the nursing homes have already been told about how it might impact them and what the department may say. And for some reason, we're not getting information that our nursing homes are getting, which strikes me as a little strange. So could you comment on that? Why are they hearing the information before or not at the same time that we're getting it?
I just want to remind everyone that we are going to vote at 10 o'clock, so we're going to try to do this quickly. We have two amendments yet. Ms. Thurlow?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I'll be very brief. As Representative Schumacher indicated, the runs will come with the fiscal note that the department, we're being respectful of sort of the traditional process. The department is, as I understand, going to prepare a fiscal note that will be ready for the budget committee, which is a standard operating procedure, and those runs will come from the department with that fiscal note so that you have the most up-to-date information. Even in this committee in the last hearing, there were changes made that will influence that fiscal note. As you've heard, even some of the additional work on property will influence that fiscal note. And so, we're being respectful that the department is working on that. I don't think, to clarify, we've been working with the department and getting technical assistance. We have tried to provide information to nursing homes, general estimates, so I don't think that there's necessarily a conflict. But again, in terms of the standard legislative process, we're respectful of the official fiscal note that will come.
Well, Madam Chair, just to finish up, Ms. Thurlow, I guess I just want to say I do understand the fiscal process and not having the fiscal note yet and all that's fine, but our nursing homes all have numbers with which they're lobbying us. And I think that's really unfortunate. That's not, I just want to say that. I mean, you don't need to respond, but it's, to be lobbied with numbers that we have no way of knowing where it came from or how we can confirm it, and, maybe that's not what it's really going to be. I think that's not a good process.
Representative Lilly.
Was there another question?
Nope.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Schumacher, thank you for the brief discussion. There is some concerns, and I thank you for hearing them. I certainly don't want to have the strong representative from Fairmont, I think, getting a bad run on his nursing home. So I know it says they were all held harmless, but and you get that, I know. To the amendment, the A3, we did discuss it at the last meeting briefly. It's pretty simple. That's probably why they gave it to me. No, it's 100% of the money, the pay increase, would go to the staff that's taking care of our seniors and our disabled folks, which we talked about quite a bit in the last hearing. The providers talk about it in their goals of the continued staffing problems that they're having. And obviously, I mean, it's pretty basic principle with employment. If you pay people well, you're going to have less turnover. We had these great testifiers this morning again from the university with staffing problems they're talking about, and then quality of service. I mean, the medication, just think about the medication that they're giving to folks, and if the person knows, going back to Helen, if they know Helen, and she's pretty cute, isn't she, Bobby? So she's so if they know her, we're going to be able to keep good folks and to reduce the turnover. As you guys vote, I am going to ask for a roll call, and the reason is because I think we should be accountable. These folks live in our district. If you look around the room, there's some in my mind, there's some big money that is behind the care providers, but these aren't the folks that live in our districts. You're going to have a few administrators, but really the people that are the cooks, the cleaners, that are really the people, that are offering this quality care. I mean, that's clearly a big weak spot, just a sidetrack in this bill where we have different work groups that are being treated differently, and I hope we deal with that as we go through too, because that's just really, it's just not really the right way to do it. But, my intent is to have folks treated fairly, treated well, and to ensure that the seniors, again, Helen, is getting quality. I can't use props on the floor, so I'm teaching you freshmen a trick here. But we can do that here, sort of. But that the money goes to the folks that really make a difference and ensure that we have quality care. So that's what the bill or the amendment's trying to do. And I've heard from folks that it's workable. That this money, if we were to do it this way, I've heard from the state and others that it would work because there is it's a reasonable number as well. There's when you look at it, there's costs related to employees. That would be off of that. If there's healthcare costs or other costs. But the intent is to try to pay people well and to maintain quality service. So that's my amendment. A3, like your vote.
Representative Lilly requests a roll call. There will be a roll call. Any further discussion on the amendment? If not, the clerk will take the roll. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Schumacher.
Chair votes aye.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask members to unfortunately oppose this amendment. I understand what Representative Lilly is doing and think that he's doing the right work with it, and I know that his heart's in the right place, but when we look at especially the 100% encumbrance, and I've spent a lot of time too this week talking to different folks who know a lot more about encumbrance than what I ever wanted to, and now I know that information too. But last week when we were talking about how there might be a workable solution in this, I got tripped up in that mindset that this was a COLA bill, that this was just a rate increase for everyone, and that's not the case. This is a reform bill that's going to be looking at the cost basis of things instead of the fee-for-service model that we have been under. And so I don't think that the encumbrance will work, especially at the 100% amount, because there are other costs that are associated with nursing facilities, including the heating and cooling of a facility and laundry and food and the whole gamut of things that would not be allowed to have any cost base to pay for that under this amendment. And so, members, I would ask you to vote no.
If not, the clerk will take the roll. Representative Urosso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, I would encourage a yes vote because all of our testimony was about the need to do employee retention. I've visited with the people in the biggest facility I have in my district, and that's their main concern, their one and only concern they voiced. I've gotten a lot of letters from people. We had an increase in the previous biennium to help take care of some of the other costs, but what we're still hearing is it's not getting down to the employees, and that's that retention and consistency is my constituents' concern.
Okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Schumacher?
No.
Tice?
No.
Baker? Christensen?
No.
Considine? Daniels? Franzen?
No.
Gunther?
No.
Keel?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Lilly?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Miller?
No.
Newton?
Yes.
Rosenthal?
Yes.
Urosso?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 7 noes, the motion does not prevail. Representative, I have an amendment labeled A4. Representative Newton, do you want to move A4? A4.
Yes, Chair, I'd like to move the A4 amendment. This amendment very simply provides for an annual cost of living for nursing home employees. And Representative Schumacher, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think this is a change that's dramatically needed, and we're moving in the right direction. But also with the annual cost of living adjustment mandated, that would be a factor that would be built into your cost as you go move forward with this. And you know, I don't want to play politics with this, and but Representative Baker was talking about how we he was embarrassed because we didn't do much in the past on this. We did do a lot in the last session, but I think this will continue to move us forward to make sure that our nursing home employees are paid fairly and across the board that the increase happens. I carried the 5% bills in the last session, and what I found, one of the things that happened was that not all of the money that went for salaries was apportioned equally. And this would ensure that everyone has adequate apportionment of funding. So with that, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I'd like to again renew my motion to move the A4 amendment and call for a roll call.
Representative Newton moves Amendment A4. Does everyone have the amendment? I'm not sure I asked that. Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
I appreciate what Representative Newton is doing here. I think that he's doing it for the right reasons, but again, for the same reasons that I asked for a no vote on the encumbrance bill. This is a reform bill and not a COLA bill. I don't see exactly how this works into the current framing of the bill. I know what you're trying to do. I think it's a good idea, but there's no money. The way this is framed, there's no money to back it up. And so if there are lean years in the government that there isn't a rate increase down the road, and there is this mandate to do the inflationary increase, that's going to put a crunch again on our facilities and what that means for them is they're going to have to do these increases because of this mandate, but are going to have to cut somewhere else. And I don't think that's really what our intent is or what we want to do, so I'd ask for a no vote.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For years, we've watched the facilities struggle and the staff struggle because we haven't been paying them appropriately. I mean, we need to be drawing a line someplace, and we're doing the reform. This, to me, is the place.
Representative Schumacher.
No,
no comment?
Madam Chair.
Representative Newton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Schumacher's point, if you know that the cost of living increase is going to be automatic, that would be built into your cost-based program. So that would be, you know, a part of the way that it's calculated annually. And that's the point that I'm trying to make, is this automatically would be a part of the program.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Nothing? Representative Newton requests a roll call. There will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Schumacher?
No.
Tice?
No.
Lilly?
Lilly? Aye.
Baker? Christensen?
No.
Considine?
Yes.
Daniels? Franzen?
No.
Gunther?
No.
Keel?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Miller?
No.
Newton?
Yes.
Rosenthal?
Aye.
Urusso?
Yes.
There being 7 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail. Representative Schumacher, do you have anyone that would like to testify on the bill?
Seeing as we have a minute and a half, Madam Chair.
I know. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 316? I am not aware of any other amendments to House File 316. Is there any further discussion of the bill as amended? And remember, we only have minutes. Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. Because this bill now moves to the HHS Policy and Finance Committees, will we have a chance to see it again, you know, to get these figures that we all have been talking about so that we know globally what the total cost will be and then individually how it will affect our individual nursing homes?
Madam Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
When the department has those ready, we'll definitely get those out.
And it will not most likely come back to this committee, but we will be able to get the runs to you when they're available. I'm not aware of any other amendments to House File 316. Is there any further discussion? Again, you got like 30 seconds, if that. Hearing none, Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 316 has amended.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Lilly.
I'm sorry. Just real quickly, Chair Schumacher, thank you for the discussion, and I hope you do consider, you know, as it moves forward, some sort of way that we can retain staff. I mean, it really is indeed a problem, and we all know it, and we, you know, it's just a matter of figuring it out, of course, but please figure out a way to do that and get the runs. You know, this is an aging committee, and I know it's not really, you know, a finance committee, but it's really, you know, our primary work is this bill, I think, you know, our problem that we're having statewide. So I'm glad you're moving it forward, but it's really the work and staffing is, you know, part of it. But I would like a roll call on a bill, please.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Schumacher, thank you for bringing this bill forward. You know, in the past two bienniums, we've seen two things. We've seen investment in nursing homes in the last biennium, and the biennium before that, we've seen dramatic cuts, which I believe you voted for, and I won't hold it against you. But there is a part, getting back to Representative Liebling's questions about the property rate system. That seems to me to be a policy decision, and we should be discussing it in this committee. And while I appreciate what you're doing, and I think all of us around this table sympathize with the intent of the bill, and we want to see it succeed, and we want to see you succeed going forward. So I would ask that we see in this committee the process for which these property assessments are going to be made, and we see also not only the runs, but all of this may have finance connected to it, but all of it is also policy, and we should see that in this committee. And thank you again for bringing the bill forward, and Madam Chair, that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 316, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Representative Lilly requests a roll call. There will be a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Schumacher?
Aye.
Tice?
Aye.
Lilly?
Yes.
Baker?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Considine?
Aye.
Daniels?
Yes.
Bronson?
Yes.
Gunther?
Yes.
Keel?
Yes.
Liebling?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Newton?
Yes.
Rosenthal?
Yes.
Urusso?
Yes.
There being 16 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails. House File 316, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Meeting is adjourned.